folks, it's been said that experience is a great teacher. I've learned as life has gone on that it's what we do with that experience as we try to apply it to our learning is the more important value. In today's episode, we're going to talk about opportunities that come our way because of life experiences we have and the impact it can have on the person we become and, more importantly, the leader we become. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Well, welcome, everyone. You're listening to another episode of Leadership Powered by Common Sense. I am your host, Doug Thorpe. Today, I have Gregory Offner, Jr., and we're going to talk about the junior part in a minute. But Gregory, welcome.
Hey, Doug. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, Gregory got my attention in looking for guests for the show because he does some coaching and training and keynote speaking now to help organizations with team performance and really organizational performance. And a lot of the work, at least as I understand it, and he can correct me later, is based on the idea of our perspective as leaders. How do we use the perspective we may be coming from, and how do we carry that forward into what we're going to? And we're going to clear all that up in the next couple of minutes. But let me start with Gregory's got a very interesting background as a musician and an entertainer. And why don't you share that with us first?
Yeah, what a hodgepodge my career has been. So, Doug, I started out as a dueling piano performer, working in piano bars. That was my night job. During the day, I worked in sales and marketing for various Fortune 100 and 500 companies and sort of ascended the corporate ladder over the years and expanded my gig set in the evenings throughout the years to the point where I've now worked in some senior levels in corporate America, and I've performed on five continents as an entertainer. All of that came to a screeching halt in 2015. When I was diagnosed with some vocal trauma as a result of overuse and misuse of my voice in both those professions, that required multiple surgeries. Doctors said if I didn't have these surgeries, I'd never speak or sing again. And as a result of that whirlwind of surgeries and healing and surgeries and healing, I discovered that my purpose, I wasn't being fulfilled by the work that I was doing. I wasn't really living up to my purpose. And so when you say that perspective as a leader is important, absolutely, I agree. And understanding our purpose, the people we work for's purpose, our organizational purpose, and even our customer's purpose, or maybe what the customer believes our purpose to be, is critical to being an effective leader. And I think just a good human nowadays.
Yeah. And excuse me, I love the idea that we're going to explore that today, because as many of my listeners know, I am big on helping people identify purpose if they don't already have a good sense of it. And I'm a big fan of the famous quote from Mark Twain. He said, there's two important days in a man's life, the day he was born and the day he figures out why. And for all of us, I think there's work to be done to really get in tune with that sense of purpose. And as you went through your journey, would you mind sharing kind of how you really evolved into that clarity of purpose?
Yeah, it took a lot of work, of self-reflection, of guidance from other mentors, because often we're so deep in the bottle of our own life that we can't really step back and read the label. And velocity, I was thinking today while getting ready for the day, about that Newton's third law, the one that talks about an object in motion will stay in motion unless acted upon by an equal and opposite force. And for a lot of us, the pandemic was that equal and opposite force. That's why we're seeing this great reset, the reshuffling of talent, people questioning their purpose, is because we finally had something that stopped the velocity of life. I had that in 2015, because for someone who speaks to sell during the day and sings for fun and satisfaction at night, when you take a man's voice away that's in that position, that is that equal and opposite force that he was talking about in that third law. And as a result of that, I questioned everything. Who I was, why I was here, how did I let myself get in this situation where I had overused and abused and not cared for my voice? And it's really a lot of the Kubler-Ross cycle of grief, that some of it was initially denial and then compromise, and I'm not getting them in the right order, but it was a process to get from there to here. And outside voices and perspectives were incredibly valuable. And I think that's why the work that you do, and for me, the work that I do, is so fulfilling, because I can apply what I've learned, what I've studied. I mean, I came out of school with a hodgepodge degree in philosophy, psychology, and music, with, you know, perfect for where I am now, but made it hard to justify in the corporate sector for a bit. That allows me to be that outside perspective to help my clients read the label on the bottle that they're in. So the way that I got from there to here was by a technique that I now use with my clients called root goal analysis. And when we talk about purpose, we are conditioned to set goals. We're trained in many cases. Some corporations have goal setting retreats, and they spend whole weeks where they get together and they set goals. I find very rarely do they get to a root goal. What we often fall into the habit of doing is putting goals forward that simply sound like good goals. Who would question that our goal is to be the industry leader in providing such and such technology or XYZ widget? Who would say that's not an admirable goal? But where we don't go far enough is in asking, which will allow us to do what? Because every goal serves a purpose of getting us somewhere. And, you know, one of the people I look up to in this business, Simon Sinek, so aptly pointed out that no one wins business. It's not a baseball game. There won't be a winner and a loser. And there's certainly no ninth inning in business. It's simply, are you ahead or behind of where you'd like to be? And where we'd like to be, I believe, is really chiefly governed by purpose. You know, when I go... I was thinking about MapQuest this morning, and, you know, when we used to go into MapQuest, well, we can get directions to anywhere so long as we know where we want to go and why we want to go there. And most of us stop at saying, I'd love to go to California. All right, well, once you're in California, what are you going to do? Once you're the industry leader, what are you going to do? Once you've become a vice president of sales, what are you going to do? And as I walk my clients and their teams through these exercises, we often find that the goals they've been after aren't the goals that really drive them. And so when a little hiccup or bump in the road or unexpected loss, you know, an account you really thought was coming in, when that arises, it's really easy for us to throw our hands up and go, well, you know, we just set a new goal. Didn't really care about that one so much. And I know this, Doug, because I lived this. This was my life as a sales professional. Here, boss, this is my quota. Really want to hit it. I don't really care. So when I didn't hit it, it was easy to go, get up next time. No big deal. But if someone had taken me through that step, identifying a root goal and saying, well, when you hit your quota, what will that allow you to do or to feel or to become? And it's a hard question to answer for a lot of us. But once we get there, and let's say hitting my quota will allow me to become the number one contributor in my team. And then it's our obligation to say, and when you're the number one competitor in your team, what will that allow you to do? And we keep going and going and going until we get to that answer that says, I don't know, it's just what I want. That's what philosophers call an autotelic goal. An autotelic translates roughly from Greek to self-goal. So the goal is in doing. Plato would call this, you know, somehow, this would say that this lives somewhere in the world of forms. But it's really, and then if we talk about flow, I don't want to get too, you know, psychology nerdy or philosophy nerdy, but
yeah.
If we talk about Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi talks about getting into a flow state where time passes quicker than we can notice, that's really what we're after, is something that we want simply for the pleasure of getting it and having it. And we can't explain it any other way. If we set goals as leaders like that, we would find we're able to accomplish so much more than we're doing currently.
you know, when it comes to corporate purpose, I'm also a big fan of encouraging leaders to help craft that purpose. And more importantly, when you take the big, you know, chrome or gold plated purpose statement that's pasted on the lobby wall, you've got to break it down to the business units that are part of that company. And so every leader at every, you know, box on the org chart needs to take the responsibility for breaking down that bigger purpose into something that can be applied to their team and that can have a much clearer line of sight for accomplishment. I learned that at an early age when I was working for a large regional bank, and I was young and stupid. And now I tell people I'm just not young anymore. We were on a track of consecutive earnings growth quarter by quarter, which is, if you're in any business, the notion of tracking earnings and growing earnings quarter by quarter on a consistent run is hard to do because there's often, you know, very unforeseen circumstances in modern speak. You know, maybe there's a supply shortage, so your volume of sales goes down or whatever. But in our case, we were on a run doing this, and everybody was asking, you know, the why. Why would we do that? And the fundamental answer was we can become a stronger bank. And for a bank to be strong, it means you can weather some economic conditions and downturns and things. And I didn't really realize how important that was going to be until a number of years later, there was a big financial turn in the markets. You know, the whole country was going through an economic impact. Here in Texas, where I am, we had both a real estate crash and an oil crash in the same window. And that's a substantial hit to banks that do real estate and oil. And long story short, every bank around us that was in what you could call our peer group failed during that time. But we didn't. We survived it. We maintained our identity, our autonomy, and even our profitability. So we had a real core discipline about how to make those earnings happen. And it was rigorous. And as a unit manager, to hit the big goal at the bank, we each had our own individual goals that were broken down for us. And there was a monthly accounting of how you were doing toward that bigger roll-up goal. And it was a discipline that was very unique. I didn't know it at the time, but I learned to appreciate it after I got out and went other places and saw how they operated. So having that, you know, big sense of purpose really, really made a huge difference. So, in one of your videos I watched, you talked about there were two aspects of perspective, and I'm probably not recalling it exactly right. Does that ring a bell? What you presented some ideas, and I think that's a key part of how you begin working with people and help them understand this idea of proper perspective.
Sure. And before we move on, I think it's so interesting that your goal or what you arrived at was to be a stronger bank. I would continue to push on that because there's more meat there for someone that's an executive like yourself who, air quotes, gets it. That's a good place to be. We want to be a stronger bank. But I also challenge leaders, as I'm sure you do, to think when we're developing these statements about the line level employee who may look at that and say, stronger bank, what do I care? There's got to be a deep connection to the work that we're doing. And as organizations evolve in this new world of work, what I really think becomes the new corporate culture is corporate purpose. Because strategy is how we're going to do it. Sorry, strategy is what we're going to do. Culture is how we're going to do it. But purpose is why we're going to do it. And that's what everybody's asking right now is, why are we doing this? Why are we still driving to work? So I think being stronger, and what you shared, Doug, was that it allows us to weather these storms. But then I think we still have to ask, well, when we weather these storms, what will that allow us to do? And drill down to what, again, you and I may just assume goes without saying, but what we really do owe it to our line level, the entry level people, to spell out is so that we can serve the community. What happens when we serve the community? Houses are built. Jobs are created. We're here to make Texas more prosperous for all Texans. Now we're getting at a purpose that shakes people when they come into the office. From there are three types of people in any business: sleepers, leapers, and keepers. And as a leader, you got to shake them sleepers until we find a purpose they identify with and get them to contribute, get them to make an impact. That's what we really strive to do with our clients, as I'm sure you do, is push them to get to that root goal. Because there are assumptions that we bring to these goals. So we go, of course we know that. Why would we say that? But we got to say it. Because if you take any three companies, take their mission statement, copy paste it, put it in a Google Doc, and copy paste the three company names and mix them up, you're not going to know who's who. They're so generic. They're so filled with buzzwords and yada yada. We really owe it to ourselves and the people we're leading and employing and the communities we're serving to drill down. And so how do we do that? You asked what was important, or what were the two important aspects of perspective? Well, one is, and what I really think you were listening to was a video where I talked about the two types of change. And there is a method of making change, and there is a mindset required for making change. There is the process and the perspective. And so many companies get the process right. They're doing a great job with process. There are tons of processes to follow, especially in financial services and banking. There's processes out the wazoo, and know your customer. And what we have a shortage of is the ability to effectively shift perspective. And that's where a lot of the work that I do with clients lands, is not how to be a better banker from a technical standpoint, write a loan better, how to count change better. I mean, that's silly, but it's how to be a better person that is a banker. And let me unpack that for a second, because some of your listeners heard that and go, who does this guy think he is? Be a better person that is a banker. 100% of our bankers, despite what some may say, are people. 100% of employees are people. And what we've done is we've taken a corporate learning and development approach to employee development. And so we spend $300 billion annually around the globe. That's the learning and development spend for corporations around the globe. $300 billion, 98% of that is directed towards technical skill development, writing a better loan, writing a better insurance contract, making a better spreadsheet. If we simply directed some of that towards building a better person, skills like resilience, gratitude, creativity, curiosity, 100% of those people go to work as bankers, lawyers, doctors, whatever they may be. And this is a controversial way to put it, but I think it hammers it home. When we talk about use of force in police departments around the country, I love the service that our police officers provide us. But the answer to misuse of force isn't more training on how to be a police officer. They go through a lot of that. It's training on how to be a better person, how to be more, how to display more empathy, how to be a little more curious. And I think when seen through that lens, any profession can be elevated by developing the people rather than just developing the employee. And that's what it's really about. It's elevating the standing of business and work, because your listeners may not know this, but work's got a pretty bad rap. You know, I've heard that some people even schedule dentist appointments when they're supposed to be at work just so they don't have to go to work. I mean, what does that say about the experience of work? And that is not fair, because it's work that builds the communities, that builds the world we live in. We've got to re-elevate what it means to go to work and make an impact. And the way that we do that is through building better people. This is what my mission has become, because for 15 years prior to my vocal injury, I was somewhere between a sleeper and a leaper. I was always trying to get to the next place, but only doing enough as bare minimum possible to get there. Nobody had poked me awake, and life did it for me. with that vocal injury, it brought me back to life, and it made me realize I had this trove of talents and interests and skills that I wasn't effectively implementing. And every employee, if you're a leader of a business and you're listening to this, every employee you have has those skills that are dormant within them right now. I call it trapped value. Every employee has trapped value. And if you want to become the leader in the banking industry in Texas, to become the strongest bank, the most cost-effective way for you to do that is to unlock the trapped value inside the resources you already have. When I worked at a piano bar, there's a quick little story. When I worked at a piano bar, I realized that we had these two pianos, we had a stage, and they were only used from 6 p.m. till 2 a.m. four nights a week. That building had a tremendous amount of trapped value in it. And so I worked with the owner to say, can we develop a bartending course here? Can we train future bartenders during the day, people who want to make a job shift? Can we find a way on Sunday mornings to do a children's program to bring, we got to have the cleaners come in and deep clean because, you know, I have some of that sticky gin that's been spilled on the floor there. So get it nice and clean. But can we bring kids in and put on a children's music show on Sunday mornings? How else can we utilize and unlock the trapped value in this property? And there is trapped value inside every person at work. And it starts, unlocking it starts with developing them more fully as a person.
I like that, that whole idea of trapped value. And with that, we're going to take a short commercial break and we're going to be right back and pick up this theme and stay tuned.
Business is all about solving complex problems as fast as you can create them. Become the best problem solver by leading others to greatness too. And the first step is going to DougThorpe.com. Doug Thorpe is known globally for coaching entrepreneurs and business leaders, improving their performance and the work output of everyone surrounding them. You can find health, wealth, and happiness by learning to lead others to health, wealth, and happiness. Go to DougThorpe.com now and order Doug's books or hire him to coach your managers. That's Doug, T-H-O-R-P-E.com.
Well, hello again, everyone. We're back, and I am talking with Gregory Offner, Jr. We left in the first half with the theme of hidden value that we each possess as human beings going to work and walking this earth. Greg, you had some ideas on how that applies to the whole concept of work. Talk to us about that.
Well, during the break, you were mentioning a concept of discretionary effort. And prior to the break, I brought up these three people that we meet at work: the sleepers, the leapers, and the keepers. And we're entering a phase of humanity, which is a weird thing to say because that feels like, well, it's going to come after that. We're entering this phase of humanity where work has changed so dramatically. It's no longer, let's find a company, work for them for 20 or 30 years, here's your gold Rolex, sail off into the sunset financially secure. Things are very different, and the toothpaste is not going back in the tube, to use that expression. So the way that we approach the industry of work, the institution of work, has to change. And one of the leading indicators of that need to change is a statistic that comes out of the BLS, the Bureau of Labor and Statistics. And that recently showed that employees are leaving their employer round about the four-year mark. So if that's the case, when it comes to employee development, a different perspective to take if you're a senior leader might be, rather than how do I keep them, how do I get them to stay? When they leave, how do I get them to be a brand ambassador? How do I build, number one, an alumni network so that I can stay in touch with them and support them on their travels? And heck, maybe they support me and they become the person that brings my organization in as a vendor. You know, like when I was an insurance broker, anytime somebody went to work for, you know, a construction company we used to insure or wherever, they're a potential buyer now of our brokerage services. So what are they going to say about their experience when they were working for me? If I'm a leader, that's foremost in my mind, because I can build this network of alumni and let's call them apostles who are out there spreading the good word of what it means to work here. And every company they go to, there's someone who's a sleeper or a leaper that's looking to go somewhere else. And so if they're out there talking well about me, maybe my inbound source of talent and recruitment, maybe that whole process just got a lot easier.
That's interesting. You know, part of what you've been saying reminds me of a situation. I have a colleague, and we actually co-authored our last book together. He's a lifelong HR professional, and he was so bold at the last Fortune 500 he worked for, he put forth the notion that HR should not be about supporting the employees. It should be about supporting the managers. But what he meant by that was, to your point, let's develop better managers and we'll have far fewer employee problems, quote, quote. You know, and it took him a while, but there was a situation, I call it transactional. There was a huge body of work that he got the chance to be appointed the number two HR guy on, and it was a population of like 50,000 employees, because this is a global enterprise. Wow. This was just a segment of their work. And corporate told him, you know what, use your idea. Let's take that carve out and let's do all of those things you're talking about. So they began the leadership development training programs for the managers to say, here's how you be a better leader so that you can do more, you know, empathy and connection and communication and collaboration and all these things. And sure enough, statistically, as that unfolded, statistically, that work group had less and less and less of all the line item problems that traditionally existed in the rest of the workforce at that company. And so it was a small microcosm of activity. And, you know, to this day, he talks about it never really caught fire in the rest of the company. They had a turnover of the CEO, and you know how that goes. They bring their whole new culture in and all of that. But I thought it was a real interesting interesting dynamic that actually played out as he expected.
Yeah, there, and I hold HR in the greatest respect, because they're really asked to do everything with next to nothing in terms of resources and authority. You know, there are so many facets. When we say HR, if you don't understand the HR world, and I certainly didn't until I was a consultant for that industry, there is HR on the employee benefits side, or on the, let's call it total rewards side, which is not just your employee benefits, but your non-cash compensation. There's the talent development and management side of things. There's the policies and procedures, you know, the hall monitors, the people police, some people call them. And then there are your generalists. I mean, there's, it goes on and on and on and on what HR is expected to do. But to your point, or to your colleague's point, I think the most valuable thing you can task HR with is the support of the leaders. Because it's, I mean, it's so overused, it feels like coming out of my mouth, but people don't quit their jobs. They quit their bosses.
Right. Right.
And unfortunately, just to carry that thought a little bit further, we also are, particularly since Jack Welch, but we're a performance promotion culture. Which means if you're the best salesperson, guess you're going to be the sales manager. Well, they are two very different competencies. And I know you and I talking are preaching to the choir here, but that's how we've built our work ecosystem over the last 30, 40 years. And that too has got to change.
Right. Well, in the first half, you mentioned Simon Sinek, and I too follow him. I like his work, and I do pay close attention. And, you know, he was describing the data that he's seeing in this so-called great resignation, that the big outcry is people leaving cultures that have for a long time been toxic, but they've been strapped in and buckled down for living it. And with the revelation of what happened during the pandemic, people came to that awareness that I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to put up with that. And if the company's not demonstrating a willingness to change into this new normal, why would I want to stick around and endure that again? And they're finally at that inflection point that they're willing to move to get away from it.
Well, what did Winston Churchill say about America or Americans? He said, Americans will do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And I think the same can be said about employees, is they'll do what they know they should do after they've tried everything else they could do. And, you know, the velocity of life got stopped for them, such that the risk profile of leaving appeared to be tremendously less than it did when the velocity of life was in full swing. And they thought, oh, maybe we operate, many of us, I do from time to time, I'm working on it. We operate out of fear. When we make our little pros and cons list, we go, which one weighs heavier? Okay. One of the skills of the seven keys, which I teach organizations, is gratitude. It's not only scientifically proven to make our lives longer, but it also makes us better decision makers because our brains are already attuned to what's wrong. You know, I joke with people and I say, cops never pull you over to tell you how well you're driving. They're trained fault finders. They're looking for you breaking the law. That's what they do. Doctors don't tell you everything that's good with your body. They generally say, you know, hey, Doug, this ain't working, or this isn't working, or hey, Greg, this isn't like it should be. They're trained fault finders. Most of us are fault finders by training, either professionally or just as a human because of how our brains are wired. We were initially wired to avoid mountain lions on the way to work. You know, now we have cars and Starbucks. So we have to reprogram our brain to notice what's gone well and then build on that. And that's really the foundation of positive psychology. And when we bring that into the workforce, we start to create opportunity where before we only saw obstacles. That was a skill I had to learn very quickly going through all of those surgeries and recoveries. Because just as everything started to get better for my voice, the doctor would say, hey, looks like you're healed up enough to do the next surgery. And then again, it was this roller coaster ride. And so developing the skill of gratitude helped me not only navigate that, but go, hey, there's something here. You know, I was looking at this recovery as how do I get back into the saddle of sales during the day and maybe singing again at night. But what if this has become the springboard to a totally different opportunity, one that might fulfill me? It would have been easy to turn and look at that opportunity, to look at that experience of all those surgeries. It's like, oh, poor, the Nancy Kerrigan approach. Why me? Why anybody? I don't know if many people get that reference, but you know, Nancy Kerrigan got her leg whacked yeah. with a steel pipe and you know, she fell. And said, why me? And it's a terrible thing to happen to her. But once we overcome that initial grief, which is totally natural for everybody to have, if we've cultivated that skill of curiosity or the skill of gratitude, we look at that and go, what could this do for me? What can I make of this opportunity? And that's where I think a lot of employees really weren't living their lives. They were sort of dying Monday through Friday, trying to live Saturday and Sunday. And now, to your point, at this great inflection point that we find ourselves at, folks have said, you know what? The ride has stopped. And while it stopped, I'm going to hop off and find one that I enjoy more. And that's a real problem for organizations because it's never been easier with Wi-Fi, with PayPal, with YouTube and all these other social channels that monetize in some cases. I mean, I saw some 17-year-old made $24 million on YouTube last year. Now, that's an outlier for sure, but do you think the average Joe could figure out a way to cobble out $40,000 or $50,000 on YouTube? Because that's about what people are making anyway. What is our value proposition as an organization? What is our employment value prop? Because we're going to be at a point in the next 10, let's say, I hope not, but 20 years where we decouple healthcare from employment, where working 40 hours that no longer equates to what I have to do to get healthcare. When that happens, what is my incentive to work for one employer full time, to really give myself? I think when it comes to being an organization and taking responsibility, the greatest ability we have to respond to a problem right now is cultivating better people who become better employees. And the way that we do that is through developing soft skills. Again, if you're a leader, you're commanding a global budget of $300 billion, right? How do we deploy that? That's the thing that we can do as business leaders that the average Joe can't. You can start a YouTube channel for 50 grand a year. You can go start your own business on Etsy or wherever. Personal development, that's expensive. And it's tough to get mentored by someone who's where you want to be. every CEO at an organization is doing very well for themselves. There's a lot of value to having them as a mentor. But there's got to be this development of the people. It's not just development of skills for an employee. That's how we're going to get there.
I agree with you. And you touched on a point that's a hot spot of mine, the legacy that we have of taking the best sales guy and making him the sales manager, or the best accountant and making them the team leader, so on and so on. And then if they struggle through that first appointment and keep the numbers running, inevitably they get identified to move up a rung. You know, they go up to the director level or the VP level, and it's either at or after the VP level that they get the opportunity to talk about talent development. And they talk about, they go to a leadership workshop, or they are provided the benefit of a coach to come in and work with them. And I'm like, yeah, but they've just spent the last 8 to 10 years, maybe 12 years, ruining work teams.
Well, and falling behind in their own development. You don't step foot on an NBA court without having had several coaches in your life. You don't step foot on a college court without having several coaches in your life, or a high school court. Why are we waiting until these professionals are at the equivalent of the NBA or the NFL or the Major League Baseball level before we start giving them access to coaches that any other top performer in the world has had for eons previously? We're doing these people a tremendous disservice. And by extension, we're doing our business and our shareholders a tremendous disservice, because we fail to develop people at the point of infancy. That's when we learn best. I have an 18-month-old daughter. If I want her to learn English, do you think I should start day one, or do you think I should wait till she's going to kindergarten?
Yeah.
Duh, right? But yet we wait on our employees and we miss a valuable opportunity.
I agree. Yeah, that's a very powerful and rich idea. Well, Gregory, we're coming up on our time here, and this has been really great. And I'm almost in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, we're going to need a second episode of this one.
Happy to do it.
So I hope I can twist your arm, and we'll do that down the road here. But tell everybody the best way to get a hold of you.
Sure. So, and thank you for asking that question. I'm on all the socials, you know, just whatever your social of choice is, generally, the major socials. Gregory Offner Jr. You can find me. I'm the bald dude generally holding a piano somewhere in the picture. If you know what I'd like to do, though, is, because I talk about this big concept of the seven keys of success, and invariably someone is out there thinking, well, wait, what are they? And more importantly, how do I implement them? Because just knowing doesn't really do anybody any good. It's, what do I do with this knowledge? So for your listeners, if they'd want to text 33777, text the word keys to 33777, I'll drop them a one sheet of all of these seven keys explaining what they are, the positives and negatives. Because just like curiosity is an asset, too much curiosity is going to keep you hamstrung and you may not get where you want to go. I think that would be valuable in helping them unpack those ideas of the seven keys.
That's great.
Social media, text keys to 33777, you know, or they can drop me an email, greg@gregoryoffner.com.
Okay. We'll put all that info in the show notes, folks. If you're on the road and listening to us live, we'll have that back in the reference points in the show notes here. And again, Gregory, thank you for your time and sharing with us a really powerful message and good word.
Oh, it's been great to chat with you, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Well, folks, this is coming up on the end of another episode of Leadership Powered by Common Sense. It's been a pleasure visiting with you, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.